Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. When are they going to get you to drive a car, Sean?
You may find out before me, so keep me posted.
Well, the other guy had this sweetheart deal where he promoted their vehicles.
I know. I could only get Kev's deal. We're working on it.
What a personality he is. He texted me from Myrtle Beach.
Really?
He was at some restaurant getting steak.
You take a picture of the dinner and send it to you? I wouldn't put that past him.
Well, that's okay, because he knows that most of his stuff arrives in my junk mail anyway. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day. The Hornets beat the Spurs. How did that happen? Linsania. Steve Martin with the call.
Lin cuts around into the paint, fades, fires, shot is up. Good! Hornets lead 89-88. 48 seconds left to go.
And Jeremy Lin at 29 last night. The Hornets beat the Spurs, 91-88. Hornets actually been playing really well down the stretch. Spurs coming off that great win over the Warriors. But last night, the Hornets beat them, 91-88. Steve Martin with the call on the Hornets Radio Network. Steve Martin has been a guest on our show before. And great guy. Really, really enjoyed talking with him. And we mostly talked not just about that. We did talk somewhat about the Hornets. But we mostly talked about his experience in the ACC. It's great to have him on. Time now to check in with how the Pirates are doing. Of course, we are your home for the Philadelphia Phillies. We did talk yesterday about the Phillies with Matt Leon. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the Pirates with Dan Zangrelli. They've taken Andrew McCutchen, the former MVP, and they've moved him up to number two in the order. Gets him more at-bats, but are there some other reasons behind this, Dan?
And I think they want to stack some guys in front of them. Obviously, the Pirates organization is very sabermetrically inclined, and if you look at some of the research that's been done on lineup construction, they actually value sabermetricians the two spot more so than they do the three spot. As a matter of fact, it comes in fourth, the number three spot, as far as pecking order is concerned. And, in Bradenton, Clint Hurdle mentioned what I thought was an incredible stat, the fact that Andrew McCutchen came to the plate 146 times with two outs and nobody on. Basically, 24% of the time, the inning is about to end and nobody is on base. So when you have a perennial MVP candidate at the plate, really not in a position to do that type of damage, you have to look for hidden advantages. The Pirates obviously known for that, and they believe that this is one. And while it's in spring training here over a four-game sample size, it's proved to be at least successful. And I think that not only does it get him to the plate more, Steve, they're looking at some algorithms, if you will, that can present him more opportunities to just drive in more runs. Because the guy's never had a 100 RBI season, believe it or not.
Right. No, I know that. And we've talked about that on the broadcast before. That's one area where people would be shocked. No 100 RBI seasons. What sabermetrics meant and analytics meant to Ray Searich as the pitching coach with defensive positioning?
Quite a bit, because he's been able to, I think, tailor a philosophy around his reclamation projects in particular, because I'm not sure if it's necessarily something mechanical, as it has been more so mindset for some of the successful guys that Searich has turned around. If you look at A.J. Burnett, he really didn't overhaul the guy mechanically. It was more so taking away from the four-seam fastball usage. Use your two-seam fastball and pitch inside a little bit more. You induce more weak contact, and if you use the two-seam fastball, more likely than not that's going to be on the ground. You compound that, obviously, with some defensive metrics and strategic shifting, you're going to induce weak contact, get more outs. And historically, over the last couple of decades, pitchers tend not to go inside. The Pirates over the last few years have chipped away at that. So that's one area where I think the metrics have really helped the Pirates look beyond some bad seasons. For instance, Ryan Vogelsong last year got roughed around. Well, the guy's using his four-seam fastball a ton, and he's not pitching inside a whole heck of a lot. So they look at those advanced statistics, and they say, and can actually run projections, hey, if we increase this guy's two-seam fastball percentage, number one, and then we actually allocate his pitch usage to a certain part of the plate, what does that project to us? Well, then obviously a guy that looks like a below-average major league pitcher on the downside of his career that doesn't have a whole lot to offer, they find value where others don't, and they're able to obviously allocate much less money to some guy there just by lifting up a few more stones and finding some gold underneath them.
Right. How do you feel about analytics? It really was coming into vogue when you and I worked together. How do you feel now about what analytics mean versus what the naked eye sees? How do you view that part?
Well, there has to be a hybrid, and I think when you and I started, Steve, I at first, admittedly, was resistant to them because you had two factions, almost like political parties, if you will, that just couldn't agree on anything. You had the math side of things, and then you had guys that had 40 years of anecdotal evidence that a lot of times was correct, more so than the actual math. And with the Pirates, they really have been able to marry the two sides together to meet in the middle, where anecdotal evidence has actually not only worked in harmony with sabermetrics, they've actually communicated well to them and asked them to measure anecdotal concepts, and they've been able to either prove or disprove some of the theories that we've seen. I think you have to have really both sides working together, because Hurdle likes to say there's a heartbeat to every gentleman and there's no metric that can measure that, and human analytics simply cannot be measured. So when you tie the two together, you're going to have a whole lot of success. So where do I fall on it? I believe that, you know, the evidence a lot of times is irrefutable, especially with the shifting. You have to do it. You'd be silly if you didn't. So no question about it. It has helped the Pirates turn around, and I've slowly but surely become a believer in it, and I have to look at it much more closely than I did, say, 6-7 years ago.
Right, and I agree with you. I think that if you use it properly, or it helps back up what you're thinking, or maybe you're thinking something and it gives you something else to think about, I think that's really important. What about the Pirate minor league guys? What kind of sense are you getting out of what could end up being the AAA group? Are they making the kind of progress where at some point a couple of these, you know, because we all, you and I both know, they're going to have to dip into that pool at some point because of injuries or whatever happens.
Totally. And it's actually, Steve, going to trickle down to Double-A, Neil Huntington was saying, because the Triple-A roster is getting jammed up. Even the 40-man. The Pirates just a couple of days ago lost Jesse Biddle, a guy that they traded for that they really liked, a left-hander that could have done some big things for them. But when they go out and acquire David Freese, their 40-man roster is just so jammed up that they have to let a guy go, cross their fingers, hope for the best that they're going to be able to retain him in the organization. That hasn't been the case in a couple of instances where they've lost guys that they really, really like. So the AAA roster is, I think, almost set. And guys that are certainly AAA ready and deserve to be on the 40-man aren't going to be able to crack Indy, and they're going to be in Double-A. So there's been some difficult conversations that the Pirates have had to have, and at that point you have to worry about the human analytics. Guys don't get salty, they don't get jaded, or they don't start pounding their fist on the table wanting move to another organization where other opportunity exists, because for some of them, they're blocked 2, 3, 4 deep on the depth chart.
Right, and that's interesting. How does the bench shape up? What, the fourth, fifth outfielder, extra infielder. You mentioned David Freese now being a part of the mix while Jung Ho Gung is coming back. So how does that shape up with the bench guys that Clint Hurdle seems to effectively use every couple of days?
you know, they want a left-handed bat there, so you would think that Matt Joyce has a little bit of an advantage, but this Ortiz guy has been swinging a decent bat of late. I don't know if he brings it up the rear as a dark horse to make the club. They do like Cole Figueroa, the on-base percentage plays. He walks more than he strikes out. He plays a number of different positions. Freeze obviously does complicate things. Then you get into roster logistics as far as are there options left on the guy? Jason Rogers has an 800 OPS in 2015, and he's a pretty good proven major league power bat off the bench, and he's likely not going to make this club because of of options, because
right.
they can burn one and it's going to come into play here. I would think that Joyce is going to make the club. They do like Figueroa. Freeze obviously complicates some things as well. Luckily, they have a guy like Rodriguez and Josh Harrison that can play the outfield. So carrying that fourth outfielder, which Joyce would fit, by the way,
right.
isn't necessarily paramount. Figueroa could put on an outfielder's mitt if it really came down to it. So I think they're going to look at, you know, almost series by series. It's going to be different the second week into the season, as we well know.
What kind of read are you getting on Josh Bell?
It's a guy who is still learning to play first base, and that process is coming slower than I think usual for a typical guy coming into the, you know, infield from the outfield. He's built like a linebacker, number one. The guy's a specimen, and the bat's going to play, but the Pirates are really, really careful about, you know, making sure that not only does a guy have a good substantial sample size of at-bats and pro ball, especially the AAA level, but they also want to see adversity. They want to see a guy struggle, because a lot of times top prospects experience nothing but success as they skyrocket through a system. And the Pirates will purposely keep a guy down there, especially in AAA, so they can ebb and flow and experience peaks and for the first time, valleys in their career. And they absolutely love when a guy goes one for his last 24, because they want to see him punch his way out of it. Because you know what? What are they going to do in late August when they go into a tailspin and you're in a pennant race? Are they going to crawl into a hole, or are they going to come out swinging? Before they even think about promoting a guy to the big league level, they want to see a couple of different scenarios where they can overcome a substantial amount of adversity and be better on the other side of it. So I think that's where Bell is. Obviously, they've committed some money to John Jaso over the next 2 years. I think Bell's going to be up here as a September call-up. I think he'll be in play next year as well. But I'm not sure that he's going to be counted on this season, because only a couple of months of AAA experience under his bat. The Pirates would probably love to get him a good 5 months of AAA ball for sure.
Yeah, no question about it. But he's just been an intriguing name that a lot of people have talked and looked at over time. How about a kid that started here at State College, Gift Ngope, who can play multiple positions? Now, he's not going to make the big club yet, but what have they liked about him?
Well, I mean, the best defender in the organization. I mean,
yeah.
The guy can flat-out pick it. Steve, he's become one of my favorite people. I mean, what an affable character, and what an incredible story trying to become the first South African to make it on a big league roster, first one to be on a 40-man roster. They love the glove, absolutely. How could you not? I think, you know, they want to groom him to be a utility infielder that can come and play defense late inning situations if needed. The bat, though, has been a bit of an obstacle. You still do have to hit your way here, but somebody who they really think highly of, and I think, heaven forbid, if something should happen to Jordy Mercer, he would be in the mix, considering it's a two-seam heavy staff. They shift quite a bit. If this staff induces a lot of ground balls, obviously defense becomes all the more important to your organization, and then you might sacrifice whatever offensive inefficiencies there are with a guy like Ngope, and you bring him up as the next man up if Jordy Mercer were to be down for any length of time. I could certainly see that scenario playing out.
Yeah, everybody really liked him here. Everybody did. He was great to be around, and all of a sudden he comes out with that South African accent. You're like, okay.
Yeah, shouldn't you be playing soccer somewhere? I mean, it's
like,
hilarious.
And, it's like when John Amici talked, you're like, okay, wait a minute.
let me process
this for a second.
Yeah, and then the smile lights up the room, and
yeah.
then he's about as kind as
oh, as not, but not only that, but you know what? He's the kind of guy that if he got to the majors, I get the feeling, based on the skill set I watched here, he'd probably be about a 260 hitter.
You would hope, and I think that eventually that could potentially play out. It's going to be a work in progress for him, I think, to get much like Bell, because those two were kind of elevated at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we are talking here in June and this guy is actually putting it together, then I think you really feel really confident about the ability to him for him to be up here potentially in September or be in play as a utility guy for next year. Because keep in mind, Sean Rodriguez is only here on a one-year deal. So if he could, you know, plug and play a little bit more offensively, man, I think he could fill the role of a Sean Rodriguez easily.
Hey, Dan, always a pleasure. Thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
All right, looking forward to it in the future, Steve. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Dan Zangrilli from the Pirates Network. We'll come back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Other guys weigh, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years. Welcome back. Great to have you with us. TCU gets Jamie Dixon. This is one of the really more interesting moves. I know it's his alma mater. Jamie Dixon, I remember I was mentioning earlier in 2001, Penn State had a basketball team that literally could beat anybody. They beat second-ranked Michigan State. They won at Kentucky. They won at Ohio State. They beat North Carolina. They beat Providence. They beat Hofstra, beat Princeton, beat Temple, beat Pitt. And when they beat Pitt, they beat him 88-74 at the Jordan Center. And Ben Howland was the coach. And eventually Ben Howland took the job at UCLA. And they elevated Jamie Dixon. And I was like, okay, well, that's an interesting move. I know he's the assistant coach, but, you know, I didn't really have a deep background on him. And in 13 years, he took Pitt to the NCAA tournament 11 times. Now, every program has its own standard. But it got to be with him. Well, he can't get you out of the first weekend. He can't get you past the Sweet 16. He can't, you know, you're always hearing what you can't do all the time. You always hear what you can't do. Everybody's very good. A lot of people are very good at telling you what you can't do. They have no answers as to what you can do, but they are very good at telling you what you can't do. And that's what we heard about Jamie Dixon, what he couldn't do. He couldn't get to the Elite Eight. He couldn't get out of the first weekend. He couldn't. Okay. But he still made it 11 times in 13 years. Early in his tenure, they had a director of basketball operations who then became the assistant coach, Barry Rorison. And Rorison did a great job of opening up a pipeline for Pitt into New York City to get talent, which was important because Western Pennsylvania has some good basketball players, but they don't have a lot of Power 5 elite basketball players. They don't. Every once in a while, one of them develops, like a Sheldon Jeter or somebody like that. But it was really that pipeline into New York City that really energized the Pitt program, and Rorison's the one that opened it up. Rorison's now the top assistant for Chris Mullin at St. John's. And the job for Jamie Dixon changed. Steve Peterson's no longer the athletic director there. He was been rather close to Steve Peterson. And the job also changed. It's now an ACC job. Now, you would think on the surface, wow, the ACC, this is great. A lot of kids want to play basketball in the ACC. Except that's not the culture of the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast. The culture of the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast was forged by what Dave Gavitt and company did with the Big East. People, you know, young people growing up and, you know, watching Georgetown, watching Syracuse, watching Villanova, watching Pitt, watching UConn, and seeing some of those epic battles between them. Then you added in Notre Dame, you added in Louisville, and the Big East was on TV all the time. And they made this into a Big East basketball area in a lot of ways. You do not have young people growing up, I want to play in the Big Ten. That's part of the uphill climb Penn State's had. You don't have people in Pennsylvania wanting to grow up and play in the Big Ten. They may want to grow up and play for Penn State, but they don't have people growing up, why I want to play in the Big Ten. That just doesn't happen. And Jamie Dixon was running into the same thing at Pitt. You don't have kids growing up in this state saying, I want to play for the ACC. Just not part of the culture. And it's not easy. That's why what Pat Chambers did, getting into Philadelphia with some like Shep Garner, with Carr, Stevens, Bostic, it all started with DJ Newbill getting Penn State and the Big Ten noticed in Philadelphia. That's not Big Ten country. And for Jamie Dixon, I think he's bought himself 5 years at TCU. They are the bottom of the ladder there in a conference that's really deep. Kansas, 12 consecutive years winning the title. Oklahoma's been terrific. Oklahoma State is like number 9 right now. They just hired Brad Underwood from Stephen F. Austin. I think Jamie Dixon looked at the landscape and said, you know, I just bought myself 5 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Lawrence is the only one in America that has a perfect bracket so far. His sense is amazing.
Uncanny, and I can't understand it.
And what's really weird is I don't think neither could he.
You're right.
We're the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. What a great dealership. Great people to deal with. Always. All right, sports bozo of the day. I'm going with EA Sports UFC, a simulation. Did you see this? They put Stephen A. Smith against Skip Bayless on their EA Sports UFC 2 simulation. What the heck? Really? Really? Have you ever watched that show?
I did a little from time to time, but I can only take so much of it.
I watched 5 minutes of it once. It was like Bizarro World.
They lean more toward NBA, and I'm much bigger of a college hoops fan than NBA.
Right. It's just not my cup of tea. That's all. Everybody has their own. Some people, they probably love it. That's fine. To each his own. New rules NFL, and then we'll get back coaching here in a few moments. 7 new rules in the NFL. Number one, the extra point from 32, 33 yards out, or the snap from the 15-yard line, permanent. 8 extra points were missed in 2014, and 71 extra points were missed last year, including the key one in the AFC Championship game by Steven Gostkowski, who had not missed one all year. Turned out to be the difference in the game. So that's now permanent. And defenses can also return the kick. Coach-to-player communication. The NFL passed a rule allowing coach-to-player communication on both offense and defense, regardless of whether they are on the field or in the coaching box. That completely makes sense. No more chop blocks. Chop blocks are now done in the NFL forever, or at least until Mike Shanahan is named the commissioner and brings them back on a permanent basis. Safety is the key there, obvious. The definition of a horse collar has been expanded. It's more than just simply grabbing at the collarbone area and destroying the offensive player by yanking him to the ground. It is now illegal to drag someone down by the nameplate, as in grab, carry, and rip him down. Again, another logical move. I have no problem with that at all, because there's not much difference between the grabbing the horse collar and grabbing the nameplate. It's pretty much the same concept. You will now get a penalty if you call a timeout you don't have. Now, you probably thought there was a penalty for this before, but there was not. It is in college basketball. It's a technical foul. And if you call a timeout now, you're actually going to be penalized for it. You know, one that you don't have. The ineligible receiver rule. It used to be a 5-yard penalty when a receiver would illegally touch a football after being out of bounds and then reestablishing himself in bounds. Guess what? Now it's a loss of down. It's a big difference. And the NFL also eliminated multiple spots of enforcement for a double foul after a change of possession. So those are the 7 new rules in the NFL. Alfred Morris is signed with the Cowboys, 1,600 yards rushing in 2012 for the Redskins, fan favorite, no doubt. Did really well in the offense when they had the zone read. His production has gone down each of the last couple of years. But at the same time, is still a good back, and the only problem for the Redskins is it's in the division. Now it's going to be up to the Redskins to competently fill that spot. And Scott McLuhan, I got a lot of confidence in him as the Redskins general manager. He's got a real good feel for it. So he must feel like he has better options there moving forward. Mike Gundy, head coach at Oklahoma State, calls the Longhorn Network a failure. And he says that one of the keys to stability in the Big 12 is to get rid of it. Gundy says the league has to market itself better, and he's right about that. So the conference, he said, is at a disadvantage because of the widespread distribution and success of the SEC network and the Big Ten network. He's right about that. He said that eliminating the Longhorn network, which he called a failure, is creating a conference-wide Big 12 network that would give the league more national exposure. The key is, though, you got to be able to do this and get yourself onto cable systems. The Big Ten network started, and the first year could not get clearance from Comcast or from Time Warner. And the first year they struggled. The second they reached an agreement with Comcast, which then dovetailed and they reached an agreement with Time Warner, the network went into the black, and each school is getting between $6 and $8 million a year, depending on the year. Each school is getting $6 to $8 million a year just from the Big Ten network part of it. Now, you got to do it by establishing it on cable systems, because the Pac-12 network is done through satellite dish. And they can't get clearances everywhere on this thing. And each little area has its own little fiefdom, and the Pac-12 network has really struggled. And the Big Ten and the SEC right now have a huge advantage, and because the ACC was asleep at the switch, they're not going to be able to get it done. Gundy did say that if Texas does not fold the Longhorn Network in X number of years, they're going to be in the Pac-12 or the SEC. If that's what they want, keep riding that horse. If you don't want that, then you'd better make some changes, or it's going to happen whether you like it or not. Now, some people feel it's possible to take the Longhorn Network and then roll it into a Big 12 network. But I think what the Big Ten did, and Jim Delaney did, they were so far out in front, and then the SEC brilliantly partnered eventually with ESPN, and it's turned out to be financially viable. But what it's done is it's going to leave the ACC and it's going to leave the Big 12 and does some part leave the Pac-12 in the dust. The Pac-12 network's struggling because they don't have a cable deal. I mean, right now, the Big 12 distributes 23 to 25 million per year to member schools. But what's going to happen is that they're going to be behind about, about 20 million per school per year behind the SEC and the Big Ten, probably starting 2 years from now. The Big Ten just now, this week, opened up negotiations on a new contract this week. I don't know anybody who watches the Longhorn Network. But you want to be able to get your games out there, and that's how you do it. I mean, that's how you do it. And that goes back to the deal with, you know, Jamie Dixon's going to the Big 12. But with Pitt, there's no ACC network. None. Everything's done by cobbling together stations. And the ACC is a great basketball conference, good football conference, great basketball conference. ACC is no better than a good football conference. ACC basketball is a great conference. Certainly there's a depth of outstanding teams. I mean, look at the fact they're 12-1 right now in the 12-1 or 13-1, one of the two. In the NCAA tournament, that one, by the way, is Pitt's loss to Wisconsin. The Big Ten, allegedly having an off year, has won 8 games.
Okay.
They have 3 teams in the Sweet 16, but it's an off year. But what kind of traction do you get now? This is not a traditional ACC area. Boston College went into the ACC solely for financial reasons. I mean, they looked at the landscape of the Big East. See, it's always the biggest problem with the Big East always was that it was a league and not a conference, and there is a difference. Notre Dame's in for basketball, not in for football. You had all these schools like Georgetown, St. John's, Villanova, and so forth that only played basketball. Then you've got the Big East football part of it, which was Pitt. At that time, it was West Virginia, which then eventually moved to the Big 12. You know, Syracuse, I mean, UConn was finally getting into it. UConn actually won the title 1 year. But Big East football without Penn State was always going to be a mess. And that's, I mean, the big reason the Big East football failed in the end is because Penn State wasn't a part of it. Simple as that. Penn State's in it almost as a bell cow, but then, you know, you got a real shot at this thing. But it wasn't. And when Penn State went to the Big Ten, that forced the Big East to then get football because they knew they're going to have a lot of trouble keeping schools. And it kept it together for a while, but it was always the elephant in the room. You don't have players growing up saying, I want to play in the ACC. You don't have that happening. This isn't North Carolina. It's not Virginia. It's not. Okay? It's not the way it is. You don't have players growing up. Now, players were growing up in this state, I think, for a long time saying, I want to play basketball in the Big East. Darn right. They're on TV all the time and so forth. What Jamie Dixon has done here is that instead of having a season coming up at Pitt where a lot of things are on the line for him, he now gets to go back to his alma mater, TCU, which, by the way, is the bottom of the barrel in the Big 12. But he's bought himself 3 years. It's a 5-year deal, but he's bought himself three, whatever happens, happens years. Nobody has any expectations for him next year down there. Nobody has really any expectations the year after. Maybe in year three some expectations start. But for him, as a business move, it's a smart move. He knows he's bought himself a 5-year contract and a minimum of 3 years where there's not a lot of heavy pressure on him. There's always going to be pressure to win anywhere. But that program's so bad that any progress he makes initially is going to be viewed as, wow, look what he's doing. Whereas at Pitt, if you don't maintain, if you don't improve where you are from being a 10 seed in the NCAA tournament, you know, you're right now thought of as a middle-of-the-pack ACC program right now. Sean Miller, by the way, at Arizona, has already said no to the job.
He's the first guy I thought of as a replacement, and I'm kind of wondering, they have a lot of pressure on them now to get a home run hire to at least keep the momentum going and not go backwards.
Well, I knew Sean Miller would be the first. I also knew Sean Miller would never take that job. I mean, he has a great situation at Arizona. Not a good situation. He has a great situation at Arizona. Depth of tradition, great fan base, Pac-12 that you can handle. He's got a lot of things really going for him there right now. Again, Pitt's not in a great spot. They're just not in a great spot. Right now they're in the middle of an ACC that's got some depth to it. I mean, football-wise, it's a good conference, not a great conference, and there really aren't that, you know, like tons of expectations there. I mean, no traditional rivalries. I mean, you got Syracuse still. I mean, Boston College coming in doesn't light anybody up. You know, so you got Syracuse there. Then after that, hey, great. They beat Duke at home. And it's great when you get North Carolina once in a while, but you have an unbalanced schedule. It's not like you're playing Louisville every year. You're not playing Notre Dame every year. You know, in terms of playing them at your place, you're playing everybody, but some of those games may be on the road. It's like the Big Ten. There's an unbalanced schedule now. So Pitt is, I would think the next guy you'll hear a name will be Archie Miller from Dayton. I think you'll hear that name come up. I think you'll hear Chris Mack from Xavier come up. Brad Underwood's already taken. He took the Oklahoma State job, so he's off the market. But I think Archie Miller will be the next guy from Dayton that you hear about. I think if he decides no or whatever, then you might hear Chris Mack from Xavier. And it's a big decision for a coach to make because Pitt's positioning is not great in the ACC. It just isn't great. Awesome facility. I mean, awesome facility. But what's your recruiting base? Western Pennsylvania? I mean, Sheldon Jeter's a really good player from Western PA. You know, I remember years ago, Dante Calabria was a really good player playing for North Carolina. But you don't have a depth of talent. There's some really good basketball players in Western Pennsylvania, but you don't have a lot of great basketball players in Western PA. So that doesn't help you. I've talked about one of the things that Penn State's been dealing with its recruiting. That's why Pat Chambers opening up a pipeline into Philadelphia has been huge. To get Garner, get Carr, get Stevens, get Bostic. It really, really got rolling by getting DJ Newbill in from Strawberry Mansion. Can't put a price on that because now it's got the Penn State name into Philadelphia. It gets the Big Ten name into Philadelphia. And it's, next year, the Big Ten tournament's down in D.C. Year after, it's at Madison Square Garden. So now the Big Ten finally moves this thing eastward. But this isn't like Indiana, where you grew up in Indiana wanting to play Big Ten basketball. It's not like growing up in Illinois, you wanted to play Big Ten basketball, where the depth of feeling goes back into the 1920s. And this is what they're facing at Pitt. You don't have a natural recruiting area. You have a great conference on paper, but you're in the middle of the pack of the conference and fighting like heck to stay in the middle. And you don't have a great natural recruiting area. That's a problem. And Jamie Dixon goes down to TCU, and he's bought him three. He's bought himself. I mean, there'll be internal pressure to win, but he's bought himself three carefree years. I mean, seriously, what are the expectations for him to win at TCU? They're the 10th team in a 10-league conference, a 10-team conference. They're 10th. They beat anybody. They're throwing him a parade. They'll come back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Great to have you with us. Again, it's amazing how the label of something on the surface can seem great. You're in the ACC for basketball. Wow. That's great. And then you realize it doesn't fit who you are. It doesn't fit your recruiting base. It doesn't light up the players you're going after. And that's where Pitt has, along the way, they've been able to do a good job of being good enough to get to the tournament. They've done that 11 of the last 13 years. But the ACC hasn't helped them very much. I think it's a, I'll point out with the, in the demise of the Big East, because there was not going to be a Big East for them to play in any longer. In the demise of the Big East on the football side, the ACC was a great landing spot for them. But in reality, it's not really helping them in basketball, and it's marginally helping in football, but that's it. I mean, that's it. I mean, I know Clemson made the Final Four. Florida State made the Final Four. But you don't ever get the sense in the ACC there's a depth of competition. You don't have an SEC West and a Big Ten East in your conference, where you look out and go, wow, Alabama, Auburn, LSU, right, Ole Miss. I mean, Mississippi State, Texas A&M. You know, you look over here, okay, Ohio State, Michigan, Michigan State, Penn State. You don't have that in the ACC. And it's also interesting, too, that one of the things that Penn State has fought is it's such a Midwest-centric conference. Bringing the Big Ten tournament to the East in D.C. next year and then Madison Square Garden the year after is huge. We had a guest on that's covered the ACC for 40 years. We had him on a year ago. And they said, yeah, next year we're going to D.C. He says that one little carrot, we throw them once in a while. He said the tournament has to be in Charlotte and Greensboro. If it's not, he says, this is where the center of the conference is. That's what Pitt's facing. The center of the conference is hundreds of miles from them. Jamie Dixon's smart enough to know that. He bought himself three carefree years before people really start caring.